is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And I would say, you know, all my relations, I used to know how to say that in Lakota. But, you know, all life on Earth, this is the reason I say this is George Johnson wrote a great piece in the science section of The New York Times yesterday. And I think it's apropos to our political system today, to Donald Trump, to capitalism, to politics. It's fascinating stuff. So let me start out by explaining how Milton Friedman and von Hayek and von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and all these kind of religious fundamental free market fundamentalists believe both economics and politics should be organized. It's an article of faith. It's really a belief system. And it goes something like this. In the days or weeks or months that it would take a legislative committee or a bureaucracy or a senator or whatever to figure out how things should be in the government or in the economy, millions of individuals have made hundreds of millions of instantaneous decisions by choosing what to buy and what not to buy that define how things should go. And so therefore, if everybody subscribes, this is Ayn Rand as well. This is this is basically the libertarian worldview. If every person, instead of supporting something like what the founders created, you know, a democracy and a republic, a democratic republic, a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, instead of that, we simply had a marketplace, whether it's a marketplace for blue jeans or cars or whether it's a marketplace for ideas. And whoever buys the most of those ideas, you know, the marketplace has its own intelligence. The marketplace will automatically come up with the best solution. This is the theology, the religion of these guys. And over and over and over again, we've seen this tried. And it always produces bubbles and busts. It always produces a very small group of very rich people and a very large group of working poor. It always destroys economies. I mean, universally. And it destroys political systems. And there's a biological analogy to this. And this is back to this article by George Johnson in the New York Times yesterday. Cellular cheaters give rise to cancer is the title of the article. And he doesn't come right out and say, you know, is Donald Trump a cancer within our body politic? But he comes awful close. He starts out by talking about how back in 1871, Charles Darwin speculated that all life on Earth probably began in a warm pond with chemicals, you know, assembling themselves into randomly and accidentally until they did so in a way that could replicate itself. And thus the first life was formed. And the early life was just interested in replicating itself. You know, the early viruses, for example, arguably not even a life form because they don't consume or excrete. They simply reproduce. And then you get more complex life forms, you know, single cell life forms, bacteria, amoebas, things like that. But then, actually, I'm not sure if an amoeba is single cell or not. I think it is, but I could be wrong. It's been a long time since I took biology. But then we get to complex life forms like you and me with hundreds of billions or trillions of cells that have to interact with each other. The way that George Johnson says it, he says, is the primordial cells mutated and evolved, ruthlessly competing for nutrients. Some stumbled upon a different course. They cooperated instead of competing. Sharing resources and responsibility, and so giving rise to multicellular creatures, plants, animals, and eventually us. Each of these collectives, George Johnson writes, is held together by a delicate web of biological compromises. By surrendering some of its autonomy, each cell prospers with the whole. And then he gets to the nub of this issue and to where I'm going with this right now, asking this question, does Donald Trump, sort of like Silvio Berlusconi in cancer, I mean, in Italy, represent the cancer stage of politics? You've heard me talk before about the cancer stage of economics, the cancer stage of capitalism. But because the Supreme Court, back in 1976 and then again in 2010 with Citizens United, has basically turned our political marketplace into a capitalist marketplace by saying that billionaires can basically buy any politician they want, as much as they want. They can spend, you know, the virtually unlimited amount of money to change the nature of elections and issues and debates. Are we now at the cancer stage? I'm not sure I'd call it the cancer stage of democracy. It's the cancer stage of a democratic republic corrupted by an economic cancer, by the cancer stage of capitalism. So back to this article in the New York Times. He says, but inevitably there are cheaters. A cell breaks loose from the interlocking constraints and begins selfishly multiplying and expanding its territory, reverting to the free-for-all of Darwin's pond. And so cancer begins. Then he explains how this works and how cancer shows up in virtually every complex life form, fish, insects, plants, mammals, birds, reptiles, fungi. And then this incredible sentence. This is in a science story in the New York Times. No wonder cancer has become a metaphor for human excess, overpopulation and consumption, environmental pollution, the concentration of resources among a hyper-acquisitive 1%. So here you've got a science writer in the New York Times identifying the hyper-acquisitive 1% in America, the Donald Trumps of America, as cancer. I thought it was just astonishing. And then you've got, I don't know if you've seen the article over at dailybeast.com. It's actually all over. The Guardian has a piece about it, and the Huffington Post has a piece about it. But apparently Donald Trump's lawyer, according to the reporter over at Daily Beast, threatened the reporters who were writing this story about an old book that was written that alleged that Donald Trump basically had non-consensual sex, shall we say, with Ivana, his wife, who has since repudiated that remark and, in fact, this morning came out and endorsed the Donald. I don't think that the whole, you know, was Donald a rapist thing is even news. I mean, it's salacious. What's news is that his lawyer said to this young reporter that he was going to, you know, sue him for everything he has and destroy his life for the rest of his life. And, I mean, if you go over to dailybeast.com, you can read the whole thing. I'm not going to read it all on the air. But it says to me that we're at the, you know, I mean, this is how, it's like slap suits. This is how corporations behave, right? If activists go after a corporation, the corporation will sue them, knowing that the activists don't have a lot of resources, and just the threat of a lawsuit will shut them up. And now this is happening in our political discourse? When the top 1%, or the top 1/1000th of 1%, Donald Trump, don't just influence politics, but become politics, does that mean that we have hit the cancer stage of a political process that has been corrupted by our Supreme Court with this ideology of marketplaces always are the best?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think so, frankly. And we'll get back to that, and there's a whole bunch of news as well that I want to share with you. And plus, it's Anything Goes Summit. We'll be back with you both. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind?
Thanks hey, for hi, watching. Tom.
Thanks wow, for watching Free Speech.
Man, you're going to get rid of white privilege. You keep talking like that.
That would be a good thing.
Let me stay on topic. You asked me a question about Henry George. the great economist who written that book, Progress and Poverty, back in 1879.
Yeah.
You said, who knows him?
Yeah.
I think everybody knows him through the property tax. He's the father of property tax. As usual, good idea got twisted.
Yeah.
And he seen wealth came from the land, and he was wondering how can that be progress and poverty. Those who go landless are always going to be poor.
Right.
So those who own the land is always going to manage the wealth. So, you know, that's I would say he's pretty much famous for that. But the main thing I really learned from that book is something I grew up with. We used to laugh at the term Indian giver. The Indian sold the Manhattan Island for $24 worth of beads and trinkets and stuff like that. You remember that story?
Yeah, it's not a true story, actually. We just killed them. But yeah, I'm familiar with the story.
True. But most of the people grew up with them stories, myths,
right.
Urban legends.
Right.
But Henry George brought it out this way. He said the real reason for the divide between the white men and the Indians was that the Indians gave up that so-called $24 for use of the island, not to own it as private property.
Right. They didn't have, most Native American tribes did not have a concept of private property, or at least it wasn't a high value within their societies. Cooperation and collaboration was more important than ownership and competition. And
right.
And also they were pantheists, and they believed that their ghosts, you know, that when people died and were buried on the land, that their ghosts hung out there. And it's one of the reasons why pretty much the only Native American conflicts that you can easily track are the ones where populations were pushed by climate change, by drought and things like that, into the territory of other populations, you know, one tribe versus another tribe. But typically, tribes didn't want the land of other tribes because they didn't want the ghosts.
Yeah, well, hey, I can understand that. I got Cherokee blood in me.
So you know.
It's just amazing how that divide back then is still with us present day.
Yeah,
you know,
you're
the
right.
Way the Europeans look at private property versus the rest of the world, you know, the corporations trying to, just what you're talking about, mixing economics and politics.
Yeah. And Henry George,
really
I think,
relevant.
You know, Henry George's theory about, you know, which essentially, as you correctly point out, Jesse, led to the creation of the property tax, makes a lot of sense for businesses, for things that are extracting money from the land, you know. And back when he was writing, I mean, we were just in the early years of the Industrial Revolution. And in an agricultural context, it made a lot of sense for farmers because, you know, agriculture is kind of a form of industry. But for people just having their homes, this is a really sad thing, Jesse, in the United States. I can tell you, living here in D.C., entire populations are being displaced through gentrification because they can't afford to pay the increasing property taxes. I don't think we should have property taxes on homes that people live in. I think that it is the tool that is used to push people out of neighborhoods. And it also means you can't really own land. You know, the state always owns everything. What do you think? Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. Good talking with you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So I guess the essence of what I'm saying is that we, you know, when cancer happens, it is the failure of a system of checks and balances. The checks and balances are that cells are programmed to automatically die. It's called cellular suicide or apoptosis, I think it's the word, I something like that. And that the ability of a cell to, well, it's not ability, it's it's not really a choice because there's not, you know, it's not like intellect like you and I would understand about. But when a cell mutates in a way that it just starts growing and growing and growing and consuming and consuming and consuming and getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and not just the cell, but the cluster of cells that are the progeny of the cell, and taking over all those nutrients, that's cancer. And so in biology, the check on that is the immune system. We have specific immune cells in our body that run around and gobble up cancer. And there are also things that we can take you know, to stop cancer. Interestingly, this is an article that was published in RiseEarth.com by Sasso Dukovic. Statistics show that breast cancer is the most common tumor among women, accounts for 22.9% of all cancers in women across the globe. Since the 1990s, numerous preclinical studies have demonstrated the anti-tumor effects of cannabinoids in a variety of cancers. This is pot. Cannabinoid receptors are overexpressed in tumor cells. Studies also show that when cannabinoids are administered and bind to these receptors, they're able to inhibit cancer cell growth by preventing the proliferation of cancer cells and by inducing cancer cell death, apoptosis, however you say that word. Furthermore, cannabinoids have been found to impair both tumor angiogenesis, the increase in local blood flow caused by tumor cells, and metastasis, the spreading of cancer to other organs. So pot does that. Broccoli does that, too, if you eat it raw. It's got two different compounds in it that combine in your mouth and in your digestive system into a third compound, which is highly active against cancer. And if you cook the broccoli, one of those two chemicals is an enzyme, and that enzyme gets destroyed. But you can add it back in by putting ground up mustard on the broccoli, and boom, you can get the cooked broccoli, and you can still get the anti-cancer effect. But the point is that in nature, there's these balancing systems. So where are the balancing systems in an economy or in a body politic? Typically, in the political world, the balancing system has been, how do we keep money out of politics and yet enable the players in our political game, as it were, or the political playing field, or whatever you want to call it, allow those players to be able to use money to communicate their message and do the things that you have to do when you run for office. I mean, you can't just say, okay, no money in politics, because that would mean that only wealthy people could run for political office. On the other hand, if you say unlimited money in politics, as our Supreme Court has said, then you have politicians going to the second richest family in America, the Koch brothers, and kissing their ring, and going to Sheldon Adelson and kissing his ring, and for that matter, Tom Steyer and kissing his ring. I mean, you have billionaires defining their particular agendas, and in many cases, the political agenda. I would submit to you that the entire Republican Party's platform, everything you're going to hear in the Republican debates, is all about what's best for the billionaires. And this is the cancer stage of politics. So this was, you know, an attempt to regulate this was what we did in 1973 after the Nixon scandals, after Watergate, and after Nixon resigned, and the Church Committee hearings and all this stuff, and we discovered all these ways that our politics have been corrupted, mostly by money. I mean, we know of several very specific bribes that Richard Nixon took personally. The milk industry bribed him. Jimmy Hoffa bribed him to get out of a criminal investigation into the Sun Valley land deal. There were a number of bribes that Nixon took. So, you know, of course, that was flat out illegal. But the political system that Nixon had been running in the White House had a lot of money sloshing around it. So anyhow, we passed all these, you know, rules and regulations to regulate money in politics. In other words, to constrain cancer in politics. And the Supreme Court started blowing those up in 1976 with the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, in 77 with First National Bank versus Bilotti. They extended that logic from individuals to corporations. The corporations had First Amendment rights, and the corporations could, you know, and the money was not money, it was speech and all this kind of nonsense. And then in Citizens United, they put it on steroids and you know, made it the overarching political. So now you've got all this invisible money coming from invisible sources, owning so many people in our political class that were arguably full on in that cancer stage. And now, for the first time, at least that, well, actually, no, this is the second time. Ross Perot is a billionaire, too. So we had a billionaire running for president back in 1992, and we've got a billionaire running for president right now in the form of Donald Trump. Is this a problem? Or was it just as much a problem when the billionaires sit in the back and say, you know, we'll just pull the strings? Or do we really have not so much a political problem, but a billionaire problem? I mean, you know, is that not in and of itself a form of cancer? We'll be back with your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Meanwhile, there is a third evolution of warfare that we need to know about. We'll get into that later on in the program. Jimmy Carter's going to drop by, too. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, there it went. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, it was an excellent rant on capitalism and cancer.
Well, thank you. Over in the chat room, somebody said you're kind of in the weeds. And so I said, somebody say weed?
Yeah.
Anyhow, back to you, Corky.
I understand it completely.
Yeah.
The only cure for cancer is you have to just starve it of the enzyme that it feeds on. And the only cure for capitalism is you have to starve it of its money that it uses beyond its profit and to pay its bills.
Right.
And how you do that is with unions.
I agree.
I don't know if you know how contract negotiations work or not. I'm sure you do.
I have some familiarity with it. My dad used to negotiate the contracts with the machinist union for Lansing Tool and Die Sinking. And two of my brothers have been shop stewards and involved in union negotiations for years, one in the printers union and one in the electricians union. So, yeah, I have never personally been, although I've been a member of SAG-AFTRA for years.
Let me explain it to the people that are listening then.
Sure.
When you sit down at a contract negotiation, you're negotiating for increase in wages and benefits. The company comes in with their books. They show the union how much they grossed, how much they made, what it cost in labor and pension benefits and whatnot.
Right.
And then you sit down and negotiate a fair increase in wages. What you're doing is you're depriving that cancer of the extra money it needs because you're paying your people fairly.
Right.
Now, the people
Which is, by the way, Corky, why from the George Washington administration till roughly the Reagan administration, wages and productivity followed each other. As companies became more profitable and more productive, or as workers became more productive and thus companies became more profitable, workers' wages went up in a way that basically reflected that increase in productivity. Since the 1980s, productivity has continued to rise at pretty much the same rate year over year, but wages have become completely flat, and all that extra money has gone to stockholders and CEOs.
And there's your cancer right there.
Yep.
There's your cancer.
And it's because Ronald Reagan declared war on unions.
Yes, exactly. I can go right back to 1980s and pinpoint exactly where things turned on its head. Right there. When they busted the air traffic controllers
union. Yeah, PATCO.
See, Reagan, he stocked the court with people who would rule against unions.
Yeah.
Right? And so he would not challenge the unions until he got the courts packed. Once he was sure that he had his people in there, then he went and busted the air traffic controllers as a test case because he had that article that said you can't go on strike if you're involved in...
Yeah, I thought he did the air traffic controllers like, you know, the first few weeks or months of his administration. You know, when he first became president.
Yeah, well, they had been packing the courts for a while.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that what PATCO did was illegal. And Reagan, when he was campaigning, had talked to PATCO and said, if you support me, I will not bust you for going out on strike. Because public employees, particularly those whose jobs are critical, by law can't go on strike. And so PATCO legally couldn't go on strike. They did. And Reagan could have used that to force, he could have forced them back to work. He could have, authorized scabs for a period of time. But instead, what he did was destroy the union.
Yes. Well, you know, this is the only country in the world where you can't go out on a strike in sympathy with the sister or brother union.
Right.
Like in Europe, if the garbage collectors go on strike, the
bus drivers do too, yeah. When did sympathy strikes become outlawed in the United States?
They always have been. Well, since the 30s.
Really?
40. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, what was that one he put in that said teachers can't go on strike? What was that?
I think that was part of the whole same thing that was used against Patco. But I'm not a labor historian. That would be, you know, we need to get a labor historian out to talk about that.
I forgot what that guy's name was who instituted that law.
Yeah.
But that was the beginning of the weakening of unions.
Yeah. Well, if you're talking, are you? I mean, 1947.
I think it was in the 35 or 40. Oh no, 35. You see, Roosevelt allowed unions to flourish because the country was on the edge.
Right. We just lost Corky? Huh. Corky, I'm sorry, we just lost you. I'm not sure why. Hopefully it doesn't mean that we lost everybody. Let's see. Amy in Madison, Wisconsin. Amy, are you there?
Oh, Tom, I have hope for the first time. Senator Langford of Oklahoma, Tom Reed from Texas, both Republicans, are working on reforms, and they're not ruling out saving the Social Security Disability Fund. I want to just concentrate on work incentives, which Paul Ryan is most interested in.
Mm-hmm.
SSI now does for every $2 you earn, you're lowered your disability by $1. I'm just hoping they take into consideration deductibles such as my long-term job support and my paratransit tickets to work.
Right.
I mean, if they take that into account, it may be doable.
Yeah, interesting point. Thank you, Amy, for that. We'll have to keep an eye on it. Jim, in Lockport, Illinois, you got a robocall about Iran?
I sure did. Yes, they were trying to knock down the Iranian nuclear deal.
Wow.
And the phone call, you know, they asked me if I was aware of it. I said yes. And, you know, they asked me if I trusted Iran. I said no, but I trusted my president. And then they just hung up.
So it wasn't even it wasn't a robocall. It was a kind of a telemarketer call.
Yeah, which I was kind of surprised. But being that Hillary has just put out this commercial on all the top candidates saying they're not scientists.
Right.
Why don't they put one out that says that they're not physicists either?
They're not what?
Nuclear physicists.
Oh, yeah. Although Mani is, you know, the guy who is the... you know, was our negotiator and is the head of the Energy Department. He is a nuclear physicist, isn't he?
He is, but not the Republican Party.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, all these people that Hillary put out on climate change saying that they're not scientists when it comes to climate change.
Yeah, yeah.
It also applies to this deal. They're not physicists either, so.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you. It's fascinating. Jim, thanks for the call. That's amazing. They're starting the robocall. They're going to put millions of dollars into this. The Israelis, the Saudis, and the white right-wing Republicans who want to deny Obama any kind of legacy. They're going to put millions into it. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hayden Morris, what's up?
I'm booked in, and I don't like war. More talk, more peace. Maybe send the Peace Corps. I'm booked in. Well, who do you choose? A Democrat, Republican? I feel like a fool. I'm booked in. I'm voting for the man, or the woman, or the trans, or the lovely lesbian. I'm booked in. Not for Hillary Clinton. I don't want another war. I don't want another killing. I'm booked in.
Okay.
No, Jeb Bush ain't he the one that stole the ballots, made his brother president. I'm voting. We're taking a stand that the government should listen to the people's Ten Commandments. I'm voting. I got a suggestion. Ralph Nader be the one to fight the people's legislation. I'm voting.
Okay, Morris, I got it. Brilliant. Brilliant. The note here says you wanted to talk about Bernie being under attack by the Democrats.
Oh, Bernie's in for it. This guy, when the Democratic machine gets through with him, you're going to think he's an African-American. Bernie is reaching the people. He is shocking. He is shocking the Democratic Party establishment. The man is not perfect. But it reminds me of something that another caller said, Professor, last week. 2,000 years ago, the Lord sent us a Jew, and he sent us another one.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Morris. Yeah, I you know, yesterday we had a caller who said, I went to see Bernie in Louisiana, and I consume a lot of news. I mean, every day I read the New York Times, I read the Washington Post, I read the Financial Times, all before I start this program. I read probably I'd have to look at the number of tabs in my computer. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 15. About 20 different websites. Just, you know, trying to be informed. And nowhere did I learn that Bernie Sanders drew 5,000 people in Louisiana, in deep red state Louisiana, in the same venue where Bobby Jindal made his announcement that he was going to run for president, and only drew 1,000 people. And Bernie drew 5,000 people. If Donald Trump had drawn 5,000 people in Louisiana, or flip it, if Donald Trump had drawn 5,000 people in a blue state, it'd be news all over the place. If Bobby Jindal drew 5,000 people, if any Republican, if Rick Scott drew 5,000 people, if Scott Walker, it would be wall-to-wall. You would hear about nothing else for 2 or 3 days. And yet this morning, Louise and I were channel flipping, and we watched the Today Show, and oh, they're talking about how to be sexy in sneakers. And flipped to Morning Joe, and they're talking, you know, they actually mentioned Bernie. They never mentioned he drew 5,000 people. Now, it's amazing, the essentially media blackout on Bernie News. Whether this is various media groups wanting to not be on the outs with the Clintons when Hillary becomes president, or whether I don't know. I don't know how to explain this. Anyhow, we'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, they do say politics is a blood sport, and Harry Truman famously said, if you want a friend in Washington, D.C., get yourself a dog. But this kind of goes beyond that. Welcome back. Yeah, in fact, where I was going with that rant was I didn't realize that Bernie had done that until I watched Rachel Maddow's show last night on MSNBC. That was the first time I'd seen any coverage of it, and it rather blew my mind. Anyhow. Rita in Chipley, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Rita. What's up?
Hi, Tom. There are robocalls if you're for Iraq Steel. And I've gotten two calls. The first time I got the call, they connected me with Gwen Graham's office.
Who is your member of Congress?
Yes, sir.
Hmm. Interesting. Did you, are you registered as a Democrat or a Republican?
Democrat.
Huh. Any idea how they got your name and number? Did they know who you were when they called you?
I belong to the Democratic Party, Democrat, where we go and call people to vote for certain people.
Right. Right. So you've done phone banking.
Yeah, a little.
Yeah. So
they do have the calls.
Yeah, and you got phone banked yesterday. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
This is going to make it look like there's a grassroots uprising. When you were connected to your member of Congress office, did you say, you know, I support the president on this?
Yes.
Well, that's good. So that
I told
kind of,
them I said, tell her she better vote yes to the Iran deal. I said, because I'll tell you now, if she runs again, she won't get my vote.
Now, did the caller, person who was phone banking or whatever this is called, who talked to you, did that person know that you were going to say what you just said, or did they think
No.
that you were opposed to the Iran deal when they connected you
No.
to your congressman?
Well, they did it where they ask you, are you for the deal, for the Iran deal?
Right.
And they said, could you say yes or no? And I said, yes, I'm for it.
Right.
And they said, if you want, we'll connect you with your...
Member of Congress.
Yep.
Well, that's interesting. So this was... So you were phone banked by somebody who is in favor of the Iran deal, apparently. Because typically,
yes.
if this was a group... If it was sponsored by a group that was opposed to it, and you said, yes, I'm in favor of it, they would have said, thank you very much. We've noted your response and hang up, rather than connect you to your congressperson.
No, but they did. They connected me the first time yesterday when they called... I hung up because I already gave her my view.
Yeah.
But I told her, like I said, I told her, you don't vote for it, you don't get my vote again.
Right. That's very, very interesting. How did your member of Congress's office react?
They were fine. They asked me, I told them, I said, I'm for the Iraqi deal. Asked me my name and where I lived.
Right. Is this a Democrat or a Republican that who you were calling?
Democrat.
A Democrat. Okay. Good. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. So we've got dueling ground games.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently. Dueling phone banking on the Iran deal, one on each side. Huh.
Yes.
Fascinating. Rita, thank you go ahead.
Tell Bernie he's got my vote.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rita, for the call. It's very interesting. I think we should all be supporting President Obama on this. This is a very big deal. And the remarks by people like Mike Huckabee recently are just, well, the president characterized them as sad. I would have used a little stronger language. But anyhow, President Jimmy Carter will be with us in just a moment. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us right now is President Jimmy Carter, 39th President of the United States, 1977 to 81, humanitarian, Nobel Peace Prize recipient, author of many books, including his latest, a brand new book, A Full Life, Reflections at 90. President Carter, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you and folks all across the nation, I understand.
Yes, yeah. We're on Sirius Satellite Radio nationwide, plus on radio stations from coast to coast, and also simulcast as television on Free Speech TV on Dish and Direct. So everywhere. Your book is brilliant, and you, I've told you this before, you are one of my absolute favorite presidents, certainly in my lifetime and I think in the 20th century, and your book is such a brilliant analysis of it. In the book, you talked about how you use... In fact, this is on page 111. You said, one of the earliest and most persistent questions when I began campaigning was, if elected, will you tell us the truth? And you said, often I would close by saying, if I ever lie or even make a misleading statement, don't vote for me. Do you think that the populist sentiment that we're seeing both on the right and the left with the non-traditional candidacies, shall we say, of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, are characteristic of that longing for somebody who's not a poll-tested politician?
I think there's a similarity there. You know, I came along in a more propitious time because of tragedies that had occurred, not only the Watergate scandals, but also the lies that were told about the war in Vietnam and the assassinations of John and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. So there was a revulsion within our country then against violence and also against lies. And I was a graduate of Naval Academy, and the number one crime there that was resulted in immediate dismissal was any kind of false statement. So if we made even a claim that we didn't step on the grass when we did, we were out of the Naval Academy. So telling the truth was a important part of my life as a Navy officer. But it was a very wonderful fit in the demands or desires of the American public then.
Yeah. And you have lived by that. And the way you've conducted yourself since leaving office has been such an extraordinary example for all of us. You also, in your book, and you and I discussed this briefly last time you were on our program, it's been a year or so ago, the Iran hostage taking, and you write, this is on page 202, although books have been written about the question was, you said, I have never known what caused the Ayatollah to delay granting the hostages their freedom until I was out of office. President Bonnie Sadr, who was elected to be the president of Iran in the summer of 1980, in the middle of that campaign between you and Reagan, has written in the Christian Science Monitor that he went to try to free the hostages in August or September, I guess it was, and was told by the Ayatollah, we can't do that. We cut a deal with the Reagan campaign. Are you familiar with that? Do you have any further thoughts on that?
I'm familiar with it. You know, there have been books written about it. But I've deliberately avoided getting involved in that allegation, which I, don't have any inclination to prove.
Yeah.
But I know that the morning that I stayed up the last 3 days and nights when I was in the White House, I never went to bed at all, negotiating with Iran and 12 other countries, as a matter of fact. And the morning of the inauguration, when I was leaving office and Reagan was coming in, the hostages were all in an airplane early that morning, ready to take off, and they were held by the Ayatollah until about 5 minutes after I was no longer president. So I was very happy to see the hostages free, but I've always had a question in my mind about, exactly why that happened.
Yeah. Well, the thing that makes it, you know, I think, a little more cogent is we've just in the last couple of years, the LBJ Library has released the tapes of LBJ talking to Everett Dirksen when he discovered August, in September or early October of 1968 that Richard Nixon's people had been in contact with the South Vietnamese and told them, don't take the deal. You know, don't, you know, and it's just anyway, we just have a couple of minutes to talk. What are, in your opinion, what's the message that you want people to carry from reading your new book, A Full Life, Reflections at 90?
Well, I think it can be encapsulated maybe in advice I got from my school superintendent, whom I quoted in my inaugural address. We must accommodate changing times, but cling to principles that don't change. And those are embedded, I would say, in the basic Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the highest aspirations of human beings in a secular or political life derived from the essence of the great religions. You know, peace, I'd say freedom, human rights, alleviation of suffering, things of that kind. And that's what I've tried to strive to achieve. In the book, I describe some of the lessons I've learned, some of the mistakes I made, and some of the corrective action that I took, which may be beneficial to the reader or interesting to the reader. Also, I've revealed some things in the book that I never wrote about before, my life in submarines, how I got along with previous and subsequent presidents, the things that I did and didn't achieve that I wanted to achieve as president, things of that kind. So I think that that's what the book encompasses. But I'd say the essence of it is that, you know, there are principles that never change, even though it's a fast-changing technological world.
Yeah, and yet political principles, for example, our Supreme Court has now said, you know, unlimited money in politics. It seems a violation of principles of democracy. In the minute or so we have left, your thoughts on that?
It violates the essence of what made America a great country in its political system. Now it's just an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery being the essence of getting the nominations for president or the elected president. And the same thing applies to governors and U.S. senators and Congress members. So now we've just seen a complete subversion of our political system as a payoff to major contributors who want and expect and sometimes get favors for themselves after the election's over.
Yeah, it's a sad commentary on things.
It is.
It's going to take a political movement to change this, isn't it?
Well, I think it's going to take either a horrible, disgraceful series of acts in our country that turn the public against it, and eventually maybe even the Congress and the Supreme Court. That would be the main thing. But at the present time, the incumbents, Democrats and Republicans, look upon this unlimited money as a great benefit to themselves, because somebody that's already in Congress has a lot more to sell to an avid contributor than
right.
Somebody that's just a challenger. So it benefits both parties.
It's very unfortunate. President Jimmy Carter, the new book, A Full Life. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us.
I've enjoyed being with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting. This over in Kansas right now, this was published yesterday, day before yesterday, on the Topeka Capital Journal. And it's a letter to the editor. The title, it's by Vern R.C. McFalls in Topeka. And the letter says, I read the recent letter to the editor concerning the need for verification of the November election vote and found it interesting. The scenario outlined was what I experienced as a poll volunteer. Right? What's happening right now is the Wichita State University's a mathematician working at Wichita State University believes to have found basically the mathematical smoking gun that the voting machines in Kansas were hacked and the Sam Brownback didn't actually win the governorship. And so there's an actual lawsuit against Kris Kobach, who is the Secretary of State. There's several different articles about this in different Kansas publications, you know, calling for greater transparency and all this kind of stuff. But here's this letter from an election volunteer. So I'll just read it straight through, and you can draw your own conclusions. Speaking of the cancer stage of democracy, and President Carter just a few minutes ago on this program saying, we have become a full-blown oligarchy. And the sooner you can pull that clip out of it, Shano, the better, because I want to play it again in the next couple hours for people who are just tuning in. But back to this letter. I read the recent letter to the editor concerning this. If you just tuned in, this is from the CJOnline.com is the website. It's the Topeka Capital Journal, the Topeka newspaper in Kansas. I read the recent letter to the editor concerning the need for verification of the November election vote and found it interesting. The scenario outlined was what I experienced as a poll volunteer. In the gubernatorial race, we experienced unusual issues with voting machines. The recent letter mentioned the voting machine showing a swing to Governor Sam Brownback during the last 30 minutes of the election. We experienced the same. In other words, at the polling place where Vern McFalls was working. We experienced the same. In fact, I believe Paul Davis, that would be the Democrat running against Sam Brownback, I believe. In fact, I believe Paul Davis was showing a small lead throughout until the polls closed. As we pulled tapes after closing our site to check for irregularities, we saw Brownback had pulled ahead in the last 10 or 20 minutes. Keep in mind, the voting machines were acting strangely throughout the evening. After the close, at least one decided to not give up its tape output without, quote, thinking about it, end quote, which is how I would put it. When I left more than two hours after the polls closed, it was still printing tapes sporadically. Our poll manager and another person from the opposing party stayed, as is necessary. Verizon Wireless 3G sending units were in use for the first time to send data to centralized data collection points. When I mentioned this to a friend who is an electrical engineer and builds boards for communications and broadcast equipment, he rolled his eyes and said, "What a simple but reliable way to throw an election." That evening was the strangest I've ever had working the polls. Do I think the elections were hacked? You bet I do. It wasn't just me either. Others voiced suspicion. Our poll manager was getting calls all evening from other poll managers who were having all sorts of problems. I leave it to you, but everything I heard and saw that evening pointed to hacked votes. Wow. And then, you know, the story of the lawsuit. It's, you know, pretty straightforward stuff. Wichita State mathematician sues Kris Kobach. Kris Kobach, by the way, besides being the Secretary of State in Kansas, is the guy who has compiled this giant voter database that covers more than 20, I believe more than 30 states, where he says that he is where. Well, the allegation is that there's a whole bunch of people who are voting twice because they're registered in more than one state. Now, it doesn't make any sense, but it has been used to knock apparently hundreds of thousands of people off the voting rolls of a whole bunch of different states. I my personal opinion, and I have nothing to back this up other than just, you know, the stories of how many people got thrown off the voting rolls in Colorado, for example, is that between a whole bunch of people being thrown off the voting rolls in Colorado, mostly Democratic voters, because of this database that Kobach has, and Mara Liasson talking on NPR in the 2 days before the election nationwide, but of course everybody in Colorado was listening to it, basically saying, "Oh yeah, no, he's not, you know, the crazy guy that you think he is." Got him, you know, helped him win the election, in my opinion. Gardner win the election as the senator from Colorado. But back to Kansas. This is Roxana Hegeman writing for the Associated Press, published in the Topeka Capital Journal. A Wichita State University mathematician sued the top Kansas election official Wednesday, seeking, this is Wednesday of, wait a minute, this must have been last week. Oh, no, actually, this was a couple months ago, April 1st. So what we need to do is find out where this thing is going. A Wichita State University mathematician sued the top Kansas election official Wednesday, seeking paper tapes from electronic voting machines, an effort to explain statistical anomalies favoring Republicans in counts coming from large precincts across the country. Beth Clarkson, chief statistician for the university's National Institute for Aviation Research, filed the open records lawsuit in Sedgwick County District Court as part of her personal quest to find the answer to an unexplained pattern that transcends elections and states. The lawsuit was amended Wednesday to name Secretary of State Chris Kobach and Sedgwick County Election Commissioner Tabitha Lehman. Clarkson, a certified quality engineer with a Ph.D. in statistics, has analyzed election result returns in Kansas and elsewhere over several elections that indicate, quote, a statistically significant pattern where the percentage of Republican votes increase the larger the size of the precinct. While it's well recognized that smaller rural precincts tend to lean Republican, statisticians have been unable to explain the consistent pattern favoring the Republicans that trends upward as the number of votes cast in a precinct or other voting unit goes up. In primaries, the favored candidate appears to always be the Republican establishment candidate above a Tea Party challenger, and the upward trend for Republicans occurs once a voting unit reaches roughly 500 votes. Clarkson says this is not just an anomaly that occurred in one place. It is a pattern that has occurred repeatedly in elections across the United States. This is fascinating stuff. But this letter to the editor was posted day before yesterday. So this has been going on April, May, June, July. This is 4 months. We're 4 months into this thing. What is going on in Kansas? I mean, it's Tom Frank wrote the book, you know, What's the Matter with Kansas? I think it's an appropriate question to be asking right now. And is it happening all across the country? And why are we continuing to use these electronic voting machines when Ireland tried them in one election and said this is crazy and literally sold them for scrap metal? The companies that make the electronic voting machines are universally run and controlled by Republicans, who in some cases have been very partisan. You know, Wally O'Dell, the former CEO of Diebold, was in Ohio. This was back in the election, the John Kerry election 2004. He said, you know, we are committed to helping bring in Ohio for President Bush. Now, I'm willing to believe that Wally O'Dell was talking about, you know, Diebold, or he was going to make donations or whatever, not that he was admitting that he was going to hack voting machines. But why, you know, if it's so easy to hack a computer, and apparently it is, I mean, you know, hackers have gotten into the CIA, they get into the NSA, they get into, you know, I mean, they took the Office of Personnel Management, they've got the records of tens of thousands, millions of federal employees. If it's easy enough to hack those, and you got voting machines that are in the cloud, right? I mean, they're sending information via Verizon. It's like, this is, how stupid do we have to be? 15 minutes before the hour. After the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So have we hit this stage of oligarchy where we're not even really a democracy anymore? It's all just charade. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And, whoops, there we go. John in Ferndale, Washington. Hey, John, thanks for listening to KBAI. What's up?
Mr. Hartman, it is a pleasure and an honor to talk to you. You were talking before about libertarians, and you know it always amazed me that people would follow a person like Ayn Rand when she I'm an atheist myself, but I love the words of Jesus, right? And that's how I try to live my life. But she hated Christianity. She thought Jesus was a fool. And you know they talk about the invisible hand of the of the marketplace, right? And it's supposed to be a marketplace of ideas. I think it's a war of ideas. And I disagree with you a little bit about the cancer frame. I mean, I can see where you get that, but I look at them as predators. I mean, anyone who would go after an old person's pension that worked their entire life and steal their pension, you know, they're cancer's mindless. This is directed activity to right. take from one and to keep for themselves. And
right. Here's the difference, though, John, between predators, natural predators in the natural world, and these billionaires, basically the human predators. In you know, when a lion goes out to the zebras going by and takes down one, that lion doesn't take another one until they're hungry again. I mean, basically, they just take whatever they need. They take until they have enough. And well, I would submit to you that you know, and cancer doesn't do that. Cancer doesn't stop when it has enough nutrients. Cancer constantly grows and constantly demands more, 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 more. And I would submit to you that that's the behavior that we're seeing, and that's why I'm using the cancer metaphor. I think you know, predators are actually a normal part of the balance of nature.
Well, that's true. It's just like, I think that Donald Trump and, you know, the evil billionaires, not the good ones, I think they think of themselves as a different species entirely. I think they look at us like a farmer looks at cattle. And I was wondering if you heard, I heard on my local station that Donald Trump had gone after Scott Walker.
Yeah.
And that's wow, he's even more out of
control. Well, he went after Scott Walker and he didn't go after Scott Walker. Scott Walker's one of his finance guys called Donald Trump a name, and so Donald Trump said, you know, here's what's wrong with Wisconsin. He didn't, however, say the kind of things that he's been saying about Jeb Bush. And Jeb Bush, he called him a loser. He said he was incapable of negotiating. It took him 5 days to even come up with a position about Iraq. I mean, he basically made personal attacks against Jeb Bush. He's made personal attacks against Rick Perry. You know, he put glasses on so he'd look smart. There were no personal attacks coming from Trump against Scott Walker personally. It was all he said was, you know, the state has a deficit. They didn't have a deficit before, you know, whatever, you know, just a couple of statistics. So I think that it is damning with faint praise, basically, you know, or maybe the reverse of that.
A feigned attack. And finally, yeah. I wanted to know what you thought of the New York Times lying about Hillary Clinton.
I think it's an abomination. It's an astonishing act I was going to say criminal journalism. That's too strong a phrase, but just it's non-journalism. I was just horrified by it, John. And I think the whole nation should be. That's the story. John, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. So Danielle hands me this story. Fighting for 50 states, Sanders' house parties expect tens of thousands. I'm guessing it's going to be hundreds of thousands. As you know, Bernie was talking to a group of 4,500 people in Louisiana on Sunday. He said, I'm here to tell you the time is now to fight for 50 states in the country. And Wednesday night, tomorrow night, Bernie will address thousands of supporters via live streaming video from a home in Washington, D.C. According to his campaign, more than 82,000 people have indicated that they plan to attend one of the more than 3,000 simultaneous local organizing meetings. Shano, you're going? You and Danielle are going. That is wonderful. I can't. I'm on the air. I'm doing a TV show at that time, and you know it'll probably be pretty much over by the time I get there. But and I didn't want to knock somebody else out of a spot. It's like all the Bernie house parties here in Washington D.C. are filling up fast. But if you go to BernieSanders.com and click the events thing and you plug in your zip code, you too can support. But anyhow, what Danielle wrote at the top of this, and it was just so brilliant. She said, if Donald Trump is the cancer stage of our political system, Bernie Sanders is the autoimmune response, or the immune response, let's say. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Len in Cedarhurst, New York. Hey, Len, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Thank you. I have two things, but the first was an idea of how I decided to promote Bernie. You know, first I bought a couple shirts, then I bought a bunch more shirts on his website.
Mm-hmm.
And I wear them when I'm flying back and forth to where I'm going all the time, which is often. So I'm walking through airports, people started saying, oh, I like the shirt. And I said, well, how much do you like it? Because I have an extra one here and I can sell it to you for $10. I paid $15. just to get more people to wear these shirts and more people to spread the word and feel positively, because obviously the negativity about the possibility still runs rampant, you know, in everyone's conversation.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, is about the economic downturn you were talking about yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and the commodity price drop that you were talking about being indicative of something. The one thing that it doesn't take into account is how much the dollar has risen over the last couple of years. So in world terms, the price of commodities hasn't really dropped so much, except the dollar's has, you know, jumped up a lot.
The dollar hasn't doubled relative to the euro or any other currencies, and the price of oil has dropped in half.
Well, the price of oil is an independent commodity.
Yeah.
Because that's a cartel-like commodity. It's not cotton. It's not lumber. You know, it's not coffee.
So are you suggesting, Len, that the amount of the decrease in commodity prices in U.S. dollars is equal to the strengthening of the dollar relative to other currencies? Because I'm not seeing those biggest shifts that large.
It's sort of like a random walk with a lot of commodities. The only point I was going to make is, you know, we went in 2008 through what would be a massive heart attack in physical terms in our economy. And, you know, it takes a long time to get sometimes after, you know, the tendency of the economy is to always grow, you know, and try and be healthier. You know, individually, everybody does, you know, make that effort for himself. And, you know, it's just that we had such a massive heart attack that I think it's going to take longer for us to build up to a point of exit. And, you know, we may see a 25% drop in the market, but it's not as though it were reflective of anything more than an overpricing to begin with.
But to use your metaphor, Len, when Bill Clinton had a heart attack and had open heart surgery, and when Henry Kissinger had a heart attack and had open heart surgery, both of them became vegans. They went on a diet that was heart friendly, nothing but fruits and vegetables and grains and, you know, no animal products. And to the best of my knowledge, they're both still on the diet. I think Dick Cheney is as well. And in other words, they made a structural change in their lives to reduce the probability of a future heart attack. We have not made those structural changes in our economy since we had that heart attack of 2008.
The primary excess was in, like you were talking about, the excess lending on mortgages. And I just went through a mortgage exercise to buy a home, and it is nothing like back then. So free money isn't going around.
No, but it is. It is, Len. We're back to, we were down to around $400 trillion in derivatives by 2009. We're back up to around $700 trillion in derivatives. And we were at $900 in late 2007. And these are all estimates, of course, from the Bank of International Settlements. But the what they're basing the derivatives on now are student loans and car loans rather than home mortgages. So they've just gone to a different product as the base product from which they derive the value to produce the you know, the tranches and the derivatives. But the derivative market is back and growing, and it's like what blew us up. It wasn't the mortgages blew us up. It was the derivatives market that blew us up.
You know, it's possible that a good number of hedge funds and other people can get creamed on that. And it's also possible that, you know, that it could be the primary cause of a problem. It could also be the answer. So in case, you know, going back to Bernie, I mean, if they just wipe most of that off the books and say, through this, you know, everybody starts from, it's like a jubilee in the student debt market.
Yeah, there you go. Len, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. We'll be back after the news at the bottom of the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with your calls. Anything goes summer. Plus, I've got a clip of President Jimmy Carter about 40 minutes ago on this program commenting on the state of our nation. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes summer. Tommy Christopher blogging over at the Daily Banner saying, come on, get over it. Bernie's never going to be president. I just sent Tommy a... Tommy's a friend. He's a good guy. I just sent him a copy of Zed Jelani's piece over at Alternet about how Bernie's actually beating the three leading Republican candidates in the most recent polls. Anyhow, Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's up?
Hi, Dr. Tom. First, our Bernie sites, there are 9 here in Alabama, and there's 1 in Jackson, Mississippi, 2 in Columbus, Georgia, are packed. We might have to change our site tomorrow morning because we're going to be spilling out into the streets. And for anybody who says Bernie doesn't pay attention to black people, it is being organized by a young black man.
Yeah.
And I don't know what we're going to do if we don't have enough space. We've got to find another site.
I just looked at during the news break at the bottom of the hour, I went through the Washington, D.C. sites because I hadn't looked in 2 days. And with one exception, every single one of them is full. All the ones within a couple of miles of where Louise and I live.
Yeah. Well, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, we're just really packing the sites.
Yeah.
And I got my Bernie Bear, and he is very cute, and he's causing a great deal of excitement. I take him everywhere.
Cool.
But when it comes to Kansas, does Brownback look like Yeltsin? And is this what was wrong with the mayor's race in Chicago? Is this what was wrong with the recall in Wisconsin? You know?
Yeah. I think those are all very legitimate questions, Norma.
And you see, we have a mayor's race coming on August the 25th, and we're having a huge battle in the State House right now because we're technically $541 million in the red, and we did our share of $11.7 billion tourist dollars. There should have been some tax money from that. Where did that go? And our governor is talking about giving the Porch Creek Indians a monopoly on gambling. They'll give us $200 million for that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a bribe?
It sounds...
McGregor and his lawsuits and the scandal behind that involving Riley, who put Don Sigelman away.
Yeah.
And by the way, we should be nice to Iran. At least they don't invoke the strictest form of Sharia law. You could look at the judge cartoon in today's paper at that. But
the fact of the matter is, in Iran, women they don't have to wear their heads covered. They work, they go to school. There are women doctors. They can drive. Iran is not Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a repressive dictatorship. Iran is a semi-oppressive, semi-democratic country.
Yeah, and so we're being nasty to Iran when they actually have some women's rights.
Yeah,
and you know. Abigail Adams, you know, she tried.
Yep.
But, of course, here, and if we go on with the TPP, we're just taking on more countries that have Sharia law and slavery. And why aren't the people of the United States standing up and screaming? Am I the only person who calls Congress?
No, you're not. And when you poll people on these so-called free trade deals, overwhelmingly Americans oppose them. And this is what President Carter was talking about. In fact, we can play that clip. Jim or Shano, you've got it, right? This is just the audio. This is President Carter was a guest on this program about 50 minutes ago. And this is what he had to say. Our Supreme Court has now said, you know, unlimited money in politics. It seems a violation of the principles of democracy. In the minute or so we have left, your thoughts on that?
It violates the essence of what made America a great country in its political system. Now it's just an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery being the essence of getting the nominations for president or the elected president. And the same thing applies to governors and U.S. senators and Congress members. So now we've just seen a complete subversion of our political system as a payoff to major contributors who want and expect and sometimes get favors for themselves after the election's over.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Dr. Tom?
Mm-hmm.
Am I still on?
You are.
Yeah. Well, you see, this mayor's race, I have spoken to you this about before, we're supposed to go in and swipe our driver's license this time, you know, and we're not going to be having paper ballots anymore that people can actually count.
We need
a national come out and count the paper ballot movement.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is being handled by that company in Nebraska. How many other of these questionable elections are electronic in which companies own the machines, who writes the software, and who's handling this? Are we ever going to have a real election without hanging chads or, oh, look, we found more votes in the closet?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, as happened in Alabama with Bob Riley and Don Sigelman back in 2002, wasn't it?
Yes, and, you know, it's happening in other elections across the country.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like I keep saying, we got 34 senators up for election, their representatives up for election, and I go around boring people and scaring them. I guess I'm talking about these things, and they look at me like, what? I said, your senator gets paid $174,000 base pay. Is he earning what you give him?
Right.
Who does he work for?
Yeah, people? I'm with you. Norma, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. I'm totally, totally with you. Thank you. Bob in Bullhead City, Arizona. Bob, you wanted to talk about Rexdale W. Henry?
Yeah, the Choctaw activist.
The Native American activist who was found dead in a jail cell after a couple of days after being arrested for a traffic violation. It's the Native American version of Sandra Bland.
You know, and that's kind of interesting. They really, at least the reports that I've gotten, because I don't watch Fox or any of that, but the information I got was really mute. There was something you said yesterday about one caller said that we can all become one, but in truth, that's not so. We can all become a union with all the different cultures, ethnics that we have in this great country.
Right.
And together we can make change. My point being is this man was just running again for a office, and he was arrested for, you know, a traffic violation, like a wrongful right turn,
mm-hmm.
and then they're found dead in jail.
Right.
This is really starting to get out of hand. How do you feel about all this? God bless you all.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you for the call. I think it's a horrible thing. I mean, his name is Rexdale W. Henry. He's 53 years old. He was found dead inside the Neshoba County Jail in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Philadelphia, Mississippi is where Ronald Reagan ran to campaign his first. In fact, Jimmy Carter talks about it in his book, how disturbed he was by the fact that Ronald Reagan's first campaign speech was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, talking about states' rights. Philadelphia, Mississippi is where the three, Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, as I recall, were murdered brutally and hidden in an earth dam, their bodies, by the Klan. And Reagan goes there to, and this is the place where this guy just died in a jail cell. Just after funeral services were held on July 19th in Bogochito, Henry's body was flown to Florida for an independently funded autopsy paid for by anonymous donors. He was a Choctaw and a member of the Choctaw tribe and was well known in the community and by opponents in law enforcement as a lifelong community activist. We're killing him off. It's and then on top of that, there's this Karama Towns wrote this back on July 22nd for Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, about 57 Native American students who did so well in school that they were rewarded with a trip to Rapid City, South Dakota to watch a hockey match, minor league hockey game. And there were a bunch of, and, you know, even the minor league hockey games nowadays have special accommodations for rich people. And so there was these corporate executive suites. And there was a bunch of drunken men in the executive suite above them, and they started pouring beer down on the heads of these 57 Native American children and yelling, "Go back to the Reds." One of them was arrested, and he's facing a conviction of disorderly conduct with a $500 fine. That's it. These are third through eighth grade students from the American Horse School. It's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Quentin in Palestine, Texas. Hey, Quentin, what's up?
My kids, when I got the email, my kids were so excited that burning was coming to Houston that they were willing to give up a planned summer trip to go river rafting.
Wow.
They were willing to use those funds to go to Houston to see burning. And when we got there, they were super excited. They wanted T-shirts. I heard people standing in line to get seats offering to buy T-shirts off of other people's backs, but
wow,
there was no vending there. But outside the stadium, there was a vendor selling Feel the Burn shirts,
mm-hmm.
and I had to tell my 12-year-old, we can't buy that shirt. because that guy doesn't work for Bernie. That money won't help Bernie.
Right.
All it's doing is putting money in that guy's pocket. So I would encourage all your listeners, Bernie's coming to your town. You need to go see him, but buy your shirts online. Go to Bernie's website, buy your shirt, wear it, be proud, but don't pay any attention to those vendors outside the stadiums because they're not helping Bernie.
Yeah. Very, very interesting and good and cogent point, Quentin. Thank you for sharing the story. How old are your kids, by the way?
I got a 21-year-old at the University of Houston and a 12-year-old, and so that helped. We had a place to stay at UH.
That is great.
Apartment.
That is great. Quentin, thanks for calling. Thanks for the story, and thanks for the cautionary note. It's all good stuff. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with your calls and the Talk Radio News Service. Bob Ney is going to drop by in about 5 minutes and tell us what's going on in the world. And welcome back. Linda in Gillette, New Jersey, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm just wondering... A good friend of mine has worked many years and put a lot of money in their 401k, and it's pretty obvious to thinking people that it's a very dangerous place to have your savings. And
well, it depends on where you invest your 401k money.
Oh, well, my question though is that there seems to be no way for her to get her money out to do what she wants to do with it. At least not from the people that she's talking to. So my question is there any firm or group of firms or people who are knowledgeable about this to help a person either invest the way they want to or to get their money out altogether? You lose like half your money.
Yeah.
If you want to take it out.
Well, and the reason why is, I mean, 401ks and IRAs and all these things were pushed very aggressively, particularly during the Reagan years and since then, as a way of having average people get some, quote, skin in the game and start thinking like Donald Trump. And so they set it up so that when you put money into a 401k, it's not taxed. You can deduct that from your income taxes. And then when you might take the money out of the 401k after you retire, it's taxed, but at the presumably much lower rate of that you'll have when you retire. In other words, you're no longer working. So you get some tax benefit, plus you can grow that money tax-free. But the downside of it is that if you try to take the money out, number one, it's immediately subject to full taxation at whatever income tax rate you're paying. And two, there's a 10 or 20% or whatever it is, there's a penalty that you get hit with when you take that money out. So if the only recommendation I can make, Linda, is to do what Louise and I have done our whole lives. I mean, we've got a 401k, but there's almost nothing in it. We just take the money after taxes and then invest it, knowing that, you know, hey, life doesn't last forever, and we might not even live to be 65. And if we need the money, it's right there in our checking account or in a, you know, in a mutual fund or whatever. And
well, in other words, you take it out as often as you can without being hit by penalties.
No, I don't. I never put money into 401ks to begin with.
We've only done that
the last 2 years, actually, because our bookkeeper got all over us about it. But it's, you know, and because we have
what concerns me is I do not trust the value of the currency itself to hold up.
Oh, I think the dollar is gonna be just fine. In fact, I think the dollar is probably going to continue to rise because of the crisis with the euro the Greece is exposing. And, you know,
you don't
the China.
Think that the market is going to crash?
Oh, yeah. But when the market crashes, the dollar typically gets a little stronger because what happens is
you lose your money that you have in there?
Well, you lose your money in the marketplace, yeah. And
right.
You know, money goes out of the economy. I mean, money just vanishes. The market crash in 2008 cost this country about $4 trillion.
That's what I'm talking about. They have money in funds, mutual funds.
Right. Well, if your money's in a 401k, you can tell whoever's administering the. First of all, you can administer it yourself. You can go to you know, I don't know the names of all these groups, but the places where you can, you know, Fidelity kind of thing, that you know, you can decide how to invest it. And secondly, if you've got an investment advisor or somebody who's managing it for you, you can simply say, I want this in you know, more liquid investments and get me out of the stock market, for example. Linda, thank you for the call. It is 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, reporter with Talk Radio News Service, is on the line with us. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true for you.
I'm trying.
In fact, I have to share with you a clip. I don't know if this is news or not, or if he's said this before, but we had President Carter on the program exactly 1 hour ago right now. And here's just a little 30-second clip of what he had to say about the state of American democracy. I thought you'd find this interesting. Mm-hmm. Our Supreme Court has now said, you know, unlimited money in politics. It seems a violation of the principles of democracy. In the minute or so we have left, your thoughts on that?
It violates the essence of what made America a great country in its political system. Now it's just an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery being the essence of getting the nominations for president or the elected president. And the same thing applies to governors and U.S. senators and Congress members. So now we've just seen a complete subversion of our political system as a payoff to major contributors who want and expect and sometimes get favors for themselves after the election's over.
So, Bob Ney, as a former member of Congress and a reporter now, your thoughts on what President Carter said?
I think he's right on target. I mean, you know, we had the scandal, for example, I was involved with and looking at the aspect of it is, I guess you'd say, small peanuts in comparison to the major amount of money that's just rolling down out of companies, pharma, et cetera. The recent, $200 million-some dollars or whatever, something outrageous on the trade bill.
Yeah.
And when you look at that, getting away for a second from a dinner or a trip, and I'm not trying to make light of it, but when you look at the big picture of millions and tens of millions of dollars in a 30-day period rolling into the coffers and a vote comes down after that, I don't know how else you relate that, Tom, except a trade for a trade. And I think President Carter makes, you know, a lot of sense.
Yeah, sadly, I agree. So what's going on in the world today, Bob?
Well, let's start with America for a second, because it's going to be a very nasty summer if the House and Senate don't do something in the next, let's say, 48 hours on the highway bill. The Senate sent a bill over. It's a six-year authorization. And the House has now said, and it was Congressman McCarthy, one of the leaders, of course, from California on the Republican side, Tom, said that it's not going to sell. They're not going to do it. They want a temporary extension.
Well, Kevin McCarthy was part of the caucus room conspiracy. In fact, he was the one who said that we're going to deny President Obama anything. We're going to vote against every single thing he wants, or words to that effect.
And he's into the, you know, leadership realm over there, and so it's you know, very powerful statement, and they've got the power to do it. And in this one, it's absolutely amazing because they're going to be denying the people of the country the ability to, you know, navigate roads. And they have to do something, so they're probably going to have to accept a temporary measure. I was told today, and I don't know how much the accuracy factor is in it, but the House Republicans want to eventually do a more extended highway bill, but want to basically kind of hold the Senate hostage, and they want some tax changes put into the highway bill that has nothing to do with highways. Now, the Senate put the reauthorization of the Import-Export Bank in there. But beyond this...
And that was Mitch McConnell's deal with Patty Murray, right?
That's right.
Ted Cruz is so hysterical about.
Yes, he's very upset to the point where he used the liar comment, which is kind of amazing. But, of course, between Huckabee and Ted Cruz, they're trying to out-Trump themselves,
right,
is what the political insiders feel is really going on. So highway bill, they've got to come to some type of agreement, and I think quite quick. And then Secretary of State Kerry was on Capitol Hill today before Congressman Royce's committee, handled himself quite well with Iran. Even Congressman Royce, that chairs the committee, Tom, when you look at his comments, he even slightly admits that this is the most intensive regulation and inspection known in the entire nuclear field. He says, Congressman Royce, the Republican, just says it just doesn't go far enough. So even they were starting to recognize this is a major, you know, intense inspection.
Well, and it's been approved not only by the administration, but it's been approved by England, Germany, France, Russia, China, the entire United Nations, and the entire European Union. And everybody loves this thing except for the Saudis, the Israelis, and the Republicans in Congress.
Well, that's right. And they're also taking statements made in Iran, which, you know, you're going to see statements out of some people, although the Iranian media has been kind of really pushed in the direction of not bad-mouthing this agreement, but you're going to see statements, especially out of the Revolutionary Guard, just as they are playing in Iran clips of a man running for president of the United States named John McCain laughing and singing Bomb Iran.
Right.
So if you look at it from that perspective, you know, a lot of, and of course, Senator Cotton, I won't even begin to go with, you know, all his...
Yeah, the 47 traitors.
Exactly. And then I just want to mention the Huckabee comment. Jewish advocacy groups are not agreeing with his comment. It's considered absolutely outrageous of you know what he has.
Well, that's good. That's good. I hope that AIPAC will come out and disavow Huckabee.
Yeah, I don't know if they have or not yet. And then there is a rare meeting, the fifth time in 66 years that Turkey has called for an emergency meeting of NATO, and they're going to do it. And, you know, honestly, Tom, seems that sometimes I think Turkey is more afraid of the Kurds than they are of ISIS itself.
Well, they've been using this permission to bomb ISIS as an excuse to kill Kurds, as far as I can tell. They've gone after two different Kurdish groups.
They have, and Turkey's trying to play the chess game way down the road. In other words, you know, have its cake and eat it too, get rid of ISIS and get rid of the Kurds. And frankly, right now, the Kurds are the only ones that really have been able to really go at ISIS, just like the Iranians in Iraq are the only reason that Baghdad has not fallen into the hands of other forces. So it's a strange bedfellow over there, but you know, obviously... You know, we've got to live with some differences out there to go after the one entity that we fear.
Spoken like a statesman. Bob May, author of Sideswiped. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great talking to you. We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Summer. Back with your calls after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, let's see. Next Tuesday is the last day. That's the day when Fox so-called News is going to sit down and tabulate the polls. But it's going to be a three-day rolling average of the polls, which means that people will be polled on Saturday and Sunday and on Monday. And Shana was just pointing this out to me. Get ready. You got right now, you've got Rand Paul desperately, you know, trying to get it to everybody's trying to out-Trump Trump. Trump has become a verb. I think it's fascinating. You know, trumped is an actual verb. But Trump, well, maybe, yeah, I trump that. Yeah, it's always been a verb, I guess. But it's become a verb with a new meaning, which means be so outrageous, so beyond the boundaries, so beyond the pale that Fox News will cover you and the national media will cover you so that you get picked up in the polls. Lindsey Graham released a videotape of him destroying cell phones, blowing them up, setting them on fire, hitting them with golf clubs, dropping them from the tops of buildings. You know, desperate attempt to use Donald Trump's attack on him to get himself up in the polls. He's still dead last in the polls. Rand Paul is like full tilt boogie. We cannot allow women to have abortions in this country. We must force all of them to continue to have their pregnancies no matter what. And the first step toward that is defunding Planned Parenthood. So that's the marker in the sand, that which is bizarre for a libertarian, because I thought libertarians were all about, you know, get the government out of your private decisions. But Rand Paul isn't really a libertarian. He's a hypocrite. He's a Republican who pretends to be a libertarian when it's convenient for him. At least his father was relatively consistent. But no, Rand Paul, no. And now we've got Mike Huckabee.
Oh, yeah, President Obama wants to march the Jews into the ovens.
Right. I mean, yeah, Mike Huckabee used to be a shock jock, a right-wing talk host, and he was the governor, and he was a minister, and he's, And so I guess he knows how to use the media. Well, no, I don't guess it. It's obvious. I mean, you know, he was a Fox News guy. He had a show on Fox. He did a radio show. He became governor, for goodness sake. So he knows how to use the media. So he's using but it's like using the force for evil. I mean, here we have an opportunity to bring Iran into the world of nations, to clean up our relationship with Iran, which has been in the crapper ever since Ronald Reagan had them hang on to the hostages so that he could beat Jimmy Carter in the election in 1980. The president of Iran, by the way, has Abdolhassan Banisadr, has come right out, has written about this. I mean, just you go to your favorite search engine. I use DuckDuckGo, you can Google whatever, and just plug in Banisadr, Banisadr, and Argo, ARGO, because he was writing about that movie, which is about the Iran hostage crisis. And it pops right up. Or Banisadr Christian Science Monitor, because it's in the Christian Science Monitor. It was an op-ed that the president of Iran in 1980 wrote for the Christian Science Monitor, saying, I tried to free the hostages, but the Ayatollah said, we had made a deal with the Reagan administration. And President Carter acknowledged on this program that he knew about that. That he knew that Banisadr had said that. He said he had no evidence to prove that Reagan had committed treason. I mean, the evidence is now out there that Nixon committed treason. It's pretty amazing stuff. The Fed Open Market Committee just had a meeting. There was no press conference. They issued a statement about 10 minutes ago. And we'll see what it says. But basically, people are reading it as maybe September they're going to start raising interest rates. So if you're invested in the bond markets, pay careful attention, because it's going to get dicey. Anyhow, back to the Republican clown car. Donald Trump, of course, is continuing to lead in the headlines because he just says something outrageous every single day. And because the marginal Republican candidates, Rick Perry, for example, has actually referred to Donald Trump as a cancer. Apropos of the first hour of this program where I said, I've been talking for years and I've written many times over the years about the cancer stage of capitalism, which is when capitalism succeeds in basically capturing the political infrastructure that creates capitalism for its own benefit and then destroys itself. Same way cancer kills its host. The cancer stage of capitalism kills capitalism. And, I mean, this is exactly what happened in 1929, and Franklin Roosevelt came along and literally saved capitalism. And it's going to happen again, and somebody's going to have to save capitalism. Who's it going to be? An awful lot. It's going to be real interesting to watch. An awful lot of how the election of November 2016, a little less than a year and a half from now, the outcome of that election is going to be defined, I believe, in part by the economy. In fact, if you look at presidential elections, particularly over the last 70, 80 years, the most consistent predictor of whether the incumbent party will be elected is whether the economy is going up or down. When the economy is going down, the incumbent party gets kicked out. And the incumbent party, of course, right now is the Democrats, because you have a Democratic president, Barack Obama. And when the economy is going up, the incumbent party gets reelected. So if it's Bernie or Hillary, if the economy is going up, actually, the economy going up would be a strong, I think, frankly, a strong positive for, particularly for Hillary Clinton, because of her strong association with the Obama administration, who would get the credit for it. On the other hand, if the economy goes down, conventional wisdom and history suggests that the whoever the Republican nominee is, either and in my mind, it's down to two people, Scott Walker or Jeb Bush. But whoever the Republican nominee is would probably become president. That's what conventional wisdom would tell you. But I would submit that if the Democratic nominee was Bernie Sanders, that he would fulfill that requirement of not being the incumbent party, right? Because the reason why people say, okay, we're going to go to the other party because the economy is going down, is because they don't want somebody who is part of the problem, as it were, that they're perceiving. So let's try the other guys. And, you know, American politics go back and forth and back and forth like that. But Bernie is not perceived as an institutional Democrat. Bernie Sanders is perceived, and he's having house parties all over the country tomorrow night. You can check this out at BernieSanders.com. But he is perceived as an outsider, and he is. He's an independent. Even though he's running as a Democrat, he is an independent, and he said, if I don't win the primary, I'm not going to screw up the election. That's it. I'm going back to the Senate, which is such an admirable thing. I mean, he is taking such a high road. He has refused to attack Hillary Clinton or any of the other candidates, declared candidates for the Democratic primary. It's really so impressive. But he could be the person who breaks that cycle. In other words, if a crash happens before November 2016, or if there's a consequential economic downturn, and the way that the Chinese stock market is going right now, the Fed is talking about raising interest rates, and these are all things that could hurt the economy. The crisis with the euro, the crisis in Ukraine, the increasing militarization of China, all of them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Even if the economy crashes on a Democratic president's watch, that doesn't necessarily mean a Republican is going to win if the Democratic guy is an outsider like Bernie. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Kenyatta in Redlands, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, you have a report on Sandra Bland. Somehow I missed that. Tell me about it.
Well, Tom, before I do that, I might as well say goodbye to you, because apparently pot causes suicide.
Really?
I mean, I'll be dead by morning.
Well, me too. Since pot has been decriminalized here fully legalized here in Washington, D.C., I have smoked it on more than one occasion. And, boy, it's nice. I mean, you know, it's nice. Anyhow, so...
Exactly. But apparently, Tom, the AP has released a report on the Sandra Bland toxicology report, which was released this morning. And apparently, she not only smoked pot in jail, or used pot in jail, to be exact, she used so much of it over her three-day incarceration that she had almost 18 times the normal level of an occasional pot smoker in her system. Now, this is interesting on a lot of levels, because first of all, you know, here we go with let's discredit the victim again.
Right.
Every time this happens, it's either old arrests or something that are brought up to somehow devalue this person's life. But I never see the cops that act so irrationally in these events ever get toxicology tests. What's up with that?
Hey, that's a good question. Kenyatta, I just went to Think Progress. I went to Democratic Underground. I'm on the New York Times site right now. I am looking for this story. Where can I find it?
It was Associated Press, and it was on MSN.
Okay. Okay.
MSN,
it's an AP story.
Has it on their site.
All right.
Yeah. So she had such a high concentration of pot in her system, and it just begs a whole lot of questions. First of all, how did she get that much pot past a search?
Right.
How did she get in there? And if she smoked it, then she had to have had some type of ignition device. So that means she had not only the pot, but a lighter and some matches as well.
Right.
And if she had that and she smoked that much of it or used that much of it over 3 days, she must have also smuggled in some incense to keep the smell down. I mean, this is unbelievable.
You heard my theory a couple of days ago, didn't you, about this?
No, I don't think so.
If I was a jailer and I wanted to seriously mess with somebody's mind, there is no shortage of edible pot around, and any police department has probably confiscated enough of it, and some of it's quite sophisticated. You know, I mean, it's in Colorado, in the states where it's legal, it just tastes like a chocolate bar, right?
Sodas and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, if I wanted to seriously mess with the mind of a person that I had in jail, I wouldn't do this, but if somebody wanted to mess with their mind, with Sandra Bland's mind, just give her an overdose of pot and let her have a Maureen Dowd evening and be totally freaked out and in despair the following morning. And the fact that she refused breakfast that following morning, that was to me the sign that she knew that her food had been doctored.
Now,
this is just my theory. I could be completely paranoid. I could be completely. But if what you're saying is true, and I'm looking here. I'm looking for a confirmation of it. I still haven't found it. But if what you're saying is true, then that I think that's the only explanation for what happened. So.
Well, you know what, Tom? I'm going to send a link over to Danielle. You take a look at it. We'll talk some more.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Kenyatta. I would like to have that. Thank you very much. Good talking with you. In fact, let me put you on hold so she can talk to you if she needs to. Thank you, Danielle. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 29. There comes the music. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, the news just broke. Actually, it says 10 hours ago, but I just got it. I don't know why this is not all over the place. I was just talking with Kenyatta, and he said Sandra Bland had 18 times the normal level of pot in her body. Actually, it turns out that she had 18 micrograms per liter in her bloodstream, which is more than three times the legal limit for drivers in Colorado and Washington State. This is really interesting. I'm not a medical marijuana expert. I know that pot is relatively slowly metabolized. On the other hand, it had been other than once or twice, like every third year or something. It's most of my 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, early 60s, I didn't smoke any pot. In fact, for my 30s, 40s, 50s, I don't think I smoked any pot at all. And since it's been legalized here in Washington, D.C., I've smoked it a couple of times. And remembering what it was like when I was a teenager, it's a very pleasant drug. And if you get the right kind, but if you wanted to really screw with somebody's brain, remember when Maureen Dowd went to Colorado after pot was legalized? And she was like, "Oh boy, I'm going to go to Colorado and find out about this pot stuff." And she went into a store, or somebody did it for her, or whatever. But she ended up with one of these candy bars that's actually like 10 doses or something. And not realizing that she had 10 doses, she ate the whole thing. And I may be wrong on the quantities here, and if so, Maureen, my apologies. But the bottom line is that she ended up spending the whole night curled up in the fetal position on her bed in her hotel room, scared to death because she was kind of tripping. I mean, when you take a really large amount of marijuana, you get into a kind of a semi-hallucinatory state, and it can be extremely unpleasant if you don't like that kind of a place. I mean, for people who've taken acid and stuff like that, it's no big deal. But for somebody who's never smoked anything other than pot, it can be damn scary to overdose on marijuana. It's not a danger. Nobody has ever died from overdosing on marijuana, but as Maureen Dowd can tell you, it can be very, very unpleasant. And when I heard that Sandra Bland refused breakfast and then was found dead an hour or so later, the alarm bells went off in my head. I was like, refused breakfast? Why does somebody refuse breakfast? Could it be that they thought that their food was tainted? Could it be that the evening before, the meal that she had been given had an overdose of marijuana in it? I mean, three times the legal limit in Colorado is presumably a fairly significant amount of pot, 18 micrograms per liter. And the reason I mentioned my own experience smoking pot is the one thing that I've noticed in my old age, and I don't think I ever paid attention to it when I was a kid, was that, you know, on the few occasions, where we live, I mean, we've got neighbors who have pot. Hey, come on over. You want a glass of wine? You want a toke? I mean, this is what's happening now in Washington, D.C., now that pot is legal. And so, you know, I've smoked it a few times, and what I've noticed is that after about, you know, it takes about 5 minutes to get high from smoking it, and then after, which is, you know, not unlike, you know, drinking a couple of drinks, and then after 3, 4, at the most 5 hours, it's gone. At least for me. I mean, maybe I have a very, very highly functioning liver. Maybe for most people it's 6 hours. But whatever. It's not going to be, you're not going to have those high levels in your bloodstream 3 days later. There will be pot in your bloodstream that's detectable 3 days later because it's fat soluble and you know, the lipid system in the body, the fat system in the body, doesn't turn over as rapidly as the water-soluble system in the body that runs stuff through the kidneys. And fat-soluble things ultimately have to end up in the liver and then, you know, getting going through the gallbladder and mixed with the, you know, the digestive acids in the gut and, you know, excreted that way or broken down. But three times the legal limit for Colorado and Washington, I think it's conceivable. And again, I mean, you know, I had my weird conspiracy theory about Donald Trump was not picking on Scott Walker. And to this day, he still has not picked on Scott Walker in an ad hominem fashion, in a personal fashion. He's just said, well, you know, there's some problems in Wisconsin. The whole reason Donald Trump is in the race is to take Jeb Bush out. Because Jeb Bush is not the favorite of the Koch brothers, and Donald Trump is part of their little merry band that gets together and, you know, they all pay each other, they all pay $25,000 a year into this thing to be able to sit together and decide who's going to be the leader of the free world next time around. So, and maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I wrote the thing up for alternate, and it's, I don't know if it's still on the site or not, but some people are like, well, you know, Trump is picking on Walker now. Well, yeah. But he sure waited a long time, and Jeb has been falling in the polls. But anyhow, my point, again, this could be another conspiracy theory, and I could be wrong. But if I'm Sandra Bland, and somebody brings me dinner, and the police department has been confiscating pot, and they have confiscated some good edibles that came out of Colorado or Washington State, where it just tastes like a chocolate bar, but it's a massive overdose. And this is actually a problem that they're struggling with in these states, is the edibles, right? If I'm Sandra Bland and somebody has slipped me a pot Mickey, basically, the night before, and I spent the whole night tripping in my jail cell from an overdose of marijuana, in the morning when they bring me another meal and say, would you like some more food? My response is going to be, no, thank you. And, you know, it's not inconceivable that she could be freaked out. I mean, she was on a medication for epilepsy, Keppra, I think it was called, that has a side effect of suicidal thoughts and sudden withdrawal from it. And she did not have this drug with her in her jail cell, apparently. Sudden withdrawal from it causes suicidal thoughts. Add that to a marijuana overdose, it's like, and name a police department that doesn't have pot in their evidence lockers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
This is raising more questions than it's answering. And why is this AP report not on the front page of the New York Times right now? I do by Michael Grusick and Jamie Stengel. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Steve Cobble, Political Director for Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, Twitter, @pdamerica. And Steve, welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Tom. Glad to be back.
Great to see you. So what are you guys up to these days?
Well, we've had a pretty fun time. For the last years, you know, we've spent a lot of time encouraging Bernie Sanders to run for president, and That project seems to have taken off a little bit.
Yeah.
You know something about that. And in particular, in the last couple of weeks, one of our strongest chapters for PDA is in Arizona, which happened to be where Netroots Nation was. So we did a lot of organizing around the Netroots Nation meeting about 10 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, Sanders went to that meeting, was involved in a protest that Black Lives Matter put on, which I think Bernie would probably agree didn't handle very well. But the interesting thing is, since that week, he's actually shown that he was paying close attention to what they said and probably capped it off at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference on Saturday night with a speech that pointed out that Dr. King had agreed that we needed both, you know, racial justice and economic justice. And
right. You can't disentangle them.
That's right. And that they're parallel problems. But he said the word structural racism. He brought up Sandra Bland's name and talked about how horrible it was to watch the video. And he basically showed that he had been paying attention and since Netroots. And
right.
We actually followed that night 11,000 people in Phoenix, Arizona. And you go, if anyone 2 months ago had gone on national television and said the Democratic Socialist is going to go to Phoenix, Arizona in a while and get 11,000 people in the convention center, they would have carted him away and said, don't ever invite that person back on our show.
This weekend he was in Louisiana, and yeah. he got 4,500.
Got 4,500. So these numbers are astounding. I think they show the great thirst for serious substantive talk about the solutions we need in this country, and that Bernie's one of the ones who's done that. You know that because it's often been on your show. But
yeah.
For his whole career, he's talked about substance and what he would do if he was in that position, and people seem to be responding to it.
Yeah, we were talking off the air before we came on, and you said, you know, it's amazing how on his Facebook page, rather than putting kitten videos, or baby videos, he's got actual substantive issue videos, and there's more people who are watching Bernie's Facebook page than any other member of Congress, to the best of my knowledge.
I think there's a great thirst for solutions, and as the money boys have pulled the Democratic Party farther and farther away
from the people,
yeah. From their working families' roots, more and more people are looking for somebody to restore that balance, and Sanders is the one who's filling that gap quite well.
So we're talking with Steve Cobble. He's the political director of Progressive Democrats of America. PDAmerica.org is the website. Did you guys just have one of your roundtables where you go in and you lobby members of Congress?
As you know, one of the biggest things going on in Washington is the fight over the treaty with Iran. Mm-hmm. There was an excellent presentation by Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. I mean, it's kind of redundant to say excellent presentation by Phyllis Bennis because she always does that. But she laid out the importance of we're choosing basically between approving this treaty or probably going to war.
Mm.
Because if we can't get this treaty defended, there's six countries in on this treaty. What country is going to trust us to do a treaty in the future if they can't do it? So this is pretty important stuff. And Phyllis laid it out. The decision period is just over the next 2 months, and we need to make sure the Democrats' backbone stays strong and they back the president on this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we did that. There was talk about the upcoming 50th anniversary of Medicare. And, of course, we've been longtime advocates for Medicare for everybody. I just turned 64 a couple weeks ago. And so sometime this year
welcome,
I have to file.
To my
yeah,
age.
Exactly. I have to file for Medicare. But it's kind of preposterous that I'm not already on Medicare.
Wait a minute, you have to file for Medicare when you're 64?
Well, you have to fill out some forms or something, or else you pay a penalty later on. You at least have to register.
Oh, really?
I think it's 64 in 6 months. Yeah. But I'm actually just learning this stuff. It's always been out there, and suddenly I'm getting told.
Suddenly we're getting older.
Yeah. You got to do some stuff here. Right?
That's interesting.
So,
is there a resource? Is there somebody you can call who says, here's what you do?
Well, I actually got mine from Kaiser, who I happen to be on through my wife's health insurance, and they want to keep me, so they're trying to they're telling me how I can do Medicare and stay on their thing. So, but they do have some websites, which I can't tell you what they are, where you can actually go check it out. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Do people get very interested in you as you approach 65? Annuity firms, you know, Social Security, Medicare, health care. Everybody,
all of a sudden,
everybody notices that you're, as you said, getting older.
Yeah. So, Progressive Democrats of America, have you been? We're talking with Steve Cobble, the political director. Have you been bringing in the past? People have, you know, brought petitions to D.C. or lobbied particular members of Congress on particular issues.
Right.
You've had roundtables where you have members of Congress,
exactly.
Typically from the Progressive Caucus. Did that just happen?
We continue to do our letter drops every month. We hit consistently every month, you know, 300 congressional offices with a set of issues that we care about that often don't get talked about. And that's in the same time range as the roundtables. So we get the Congress people or their staff to come talk to us. We get the advocates like Phyllis Bennis, like Steve Miles of Win Without War. They come and tell us what's going on and where we have to apply pressure, or as we like to say, educate. Mm-hmm. And Andrea Miller of People Demanding Action, which is our C4 branch, they carry on the roundtable and they help to get these letters distributed to the district offices. So you apply the pressure in the place where you live.
Great.
And we've been doing that and continue to do that, and it's a valuable service, I think.
And teaching people how to do it, too.
Yeah, and we have a constituency in Progressive Democrats that likes doing things. They're happy to sign online petitions, too, but we have a core group of people who like going to the congressional office and actually taking action every month, and that's a very useful thing.
Right, and if you want to sign up for that and participate in it, go to pdamerica.org. And how's PD America doing now since Tim Carpenter passed away?
Well, we're doing pretty well. I mean, Tim, as you know, played a big role in our decision to try to push Bernie Sanders to run for president as a Democrat. And if I remember right, you were up in Massachusetts right after Tim died, and we had the memorial service to him, and Senator Sanders came and spoke to us, and it was sort of the kickoff, at least in our minds, of Bernie run. He hadn't actually said yes yet, but we chanted at him and gave him 12,000 petitions. And so the organization's kept very busy in the last year making it clear to Senator Sanders that if he decided to do this, we'd be with him, that there would be volunteers in every state, that people would respond to his issues. Now, I don't want to say we did it all. We played a value-added role in making it clear that it was a safe thing to do. And once Senator Warren made it clear that she was not going to do it, I think the opening there was clear, and there was an opening towards real people that was not being filled in by anybody running. And Sanders is filling that. So we've been very busy. The organization's doing well. We're having house parties where we raise money for our own people to help Bernie. I'm thinking and hoping that pretty soon Bernie will put us out of business on that, because as he spreads his organization.
Oh, look at what's going on with these house parties
tomorrow
night. Yeah. You know, you can't find an open spot anymore.
They're going to be massive, right?
You go to BernieSanders.com and plug in your zip code, and it's like, you know, there was only one place within a few miles of where Louise and I live that still had some spots. And it was some guy's house that was like in the back corner of a building, and he was like, go around the back way. And I'm thinking, you know, probably certainly single women would be reluctant to do that. And maybe a lot of people would.
I think you're right. I'm expecting them tomorrow to begin the process of issuing at least preliminary organizing instructions. Okay, here's thousands of you all over the country. Here's what we need to do so that we can get on the ballot, so that we can organize into at least a coordinated volunteer structure and all be working in the same direction. And as they do that, some of the work that PDA has been doing over the last year in states where Sanders was not yet, outside of Iowa and New Hampshire, that won't be necessary anymore. This campaign will take it over itself, and we'll have to figure out new ways to be useful to the campaign. We are running independently at this point, due to the FEC rules, so we don't coordinate with them.
Right.
But if you understand your presidential process, you don't have to be too much of a genius to figure out what can be useful.
So you're like a super PAC without a billionaire.
Yeah, we have no billionaires, and you said that pretty
super
well.
Super PAC run on $10 donations.
Yeah, PDA has been a federal PAC all its career, and it's never, in any single year, it's never approached seven figures. So yeah. We never had a Sheldon Adelson, Charles Koch type.
Never had $1 million. Just,
no.
We
could say it's because of our purity. It's probably just our bad fundraising, but what the heck?
Well, no, I think it's because of your purity. Progressive Democrats of America has never compromised. You guys have always taken genuinely progressive positions. You've always been willing to speak truth to power, and you're continuing in that tradition. Steve Cobble, the political director of Progressive Democrats of America. The website is pdamerica.org, so get over and check it out. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's always great to be here.
Yeah, it's great talking with you. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls, and it looks like the Sandra Bland information at least is starting to filter into the corporate media. We'll see where this goes. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You had some thoughts on Sandra Bland?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, as far as the people in, where was that, in Warren County in here in Texas?
Yeah.
Spiking her food with weed, I just don't know why they would do that. Why wouldn't they spike it with something like angel dust or LSD or something, you know, because it would be hard for, it's going to be hard for them to explain how she got a hold of weed in jail.
Again, putting my conspiracy theory hat on here, if you take MMDA, angel dust, ecstasy, LSD, these are all water-soluble compounds that flush out of your body in a day or so, and they're pretty much gone. So if amphetamines, cocaine, they're all water-soluble. Pot is one of the few fat-soluble, you know, where the psychoactive compound is principally fat-soluble instead of water-soluble. Which is why when you make tinctures, you've got to make them with alcohol or you've got to make them with butter instead of with water. And
No, I understand that.
Here's my theory on this. If they found her dead from suicide and they found the small amounts of residue from acid or MMDA or whatever that would still be present and detectable at that point from having had her meal spiked the night before, it would be clear that she had to have been doped in jail. Whereas the conventional wisdom, and probably this is the level of sophistication about drug use that is extant at the county sheriff's office there in Texas, is that pot stays in your bloodstream for up to a month. And so I'm, you know, again, if this conspiracy theory of mine is right, and I hope it's wrong, I hope I'm absolutely wrong. But if I'm right, they might have thought that we can overdose her with marijuana, and when they do the toxicology, they'll say, oh, gee, look, there's pot in her bloodstream. Well, pot stays in people's bloodstreams for up to a month, so she probably smoked pot. In fact, she was probably high, and that's why she was, combative or whatever the word was that they used against officer so-and-so.
Well, she didn't seem high.
I know she didn't seem high. In the video, she was crystal clear in the way that she was speaking and what she was saying and how she was behaving. It did not look to me like she was high. On the other hand, you know, people who use pot regularly, sometimes you can't tell. But now these experts are saying, this guy, the chief toxicologist at Tarrant County at the medical examiner's office in Fort Worth, Texas, Robert Johnson, he said, I have never seen a report in the literature or from any other source of residual THC that high 3 days after someone stops using the drug.
Yeah, I think the whole thing is very odd, but I don't know if it would accumulate, you know, if she'd been using it for a long time or something like that, and they were to...
I don't think that's enough.
I don't really know.
That's not enough. And there was nobody in jail with her.
Yeah, the whole thing doesn't make any sense, but, you know, I don't know if they just leaked this and you know, to try to disparage her reputation and that kind of thing. But I don't know whether she committed suicide or whether she was something strange happened.
I think you trip somebody out really badly and fill them with despair by putting them in jail and telling them that they're facing years in prison. you know, suicide starts looking like an option. So I don't know, Anita. It's just it's a grim topic. Anita, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. This is interesting. The toxicology report has come back on Sandra Bland. And it says that she has 18 micrograms per liter of THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient in marijuana, in her bloodstream. 18 micrograms per liter. That's three times the legal limit for drivers in Colorado, which must be, what, 6 times 3 is 18? Am I doing my math right? Yeah, so it must be 6 micrograms is the legal limit. So this is three times that. The chief toxicologist for Tarrant County, which is Fort Worth, Texas, who's got no dog in this fight, his name is Robert Johnson. He said, and I quote, "She either had access to the drug in jail or she was a consistent user of the drug in her body. It accumulated THC to the point where it was slowly releasing it over time. But," he says, "I have never seen a report in the literature or from any other source of residual THC that high 3 days after someone stops using the drug." So this woman was heavily dosed with marijuana, apparently within 24 hours of her having died. She turned down breakfast. What's that all about? I think there's something very, 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 very... I was going to say very dark, and then that reminded me of how our language denigrates dark skin. It's there's something anyhow, something very wrong going on here. Rich in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich, you wanted to comment on this?
Hi. How are you doing, by the way?
Good. Thank you.
Good. Great. I've been using and growing cannabis for roughly 35 years. And I always recommend when people use edibles to be very, very cautious. Roughly after 2 to 4 hours of smoking cannabis, it breaks down into a metabolite called THC-11, which is no longer psychoactive. But when it is eaten, it can last over 24 hours and takes a long time to break down. And if she was given an amount that much, it's really highly possible that she experienced psychosis.
Right. Yeah, that's I was calling it tripping, but you're using the correct term. You can induce a psychosis in a vulnerable person with an overdose of marijuana.
And I've had edibles, and I generally don't like them because I don't know how much is in them, you know, and they can cause, I've seen a 300-pound man have to crawl into a room because he ate a bowl of silly chili.
Right.
That was dosed really strong.
Yeah.
And, yeah, if they did that to her, man, they should be punished horribly because that's just wrong.
And if they didn't do it to her, how did it get in her bloodstream? Because
was it that high? That would be really interesting to find out how much metabolite, you know, how much it had metabolized when they tested her. Because then you would know for sure when she ate it, because it metabolizes at a pretty predictable rate.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. And as the DA for Waller County, which is the jail that she was in, the DA Elton Mathis declined to comment. But one of his prosecutors, Warren Depram, said that he wouldn't rule out the drug being smuggled into jail. Right. How did that happen? Meanwhile, on Monday, it was announced that a committee of outside attorneys will assist Mathis in investigating Bland's death. We'll see where this goes. Rich, thanks for sharing your insight and experience with us. I appreciate it. Drew in Olathe, Kansas. Hey, Drew, you wanted to get back to did Sam Brownback's campaign or somebody on his behalf hack the voting machines in Kansas?
Yeah, I remember it was either you or Mark or both. I told you that, you know, something about this didn't sit right with me about Sam, about Brownback winning, especially as big as he won, because there were a lot of Republican groups out here that were, like, against Brownback and throwing their support to Paul Davis.
Oh, he had ruined the state financially.
Oh, I despise the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is why it just... I thought, you know, there's got to be something up with the hacking or something with those electronic voting machines, which is why I always ask for a paper ballot. I just don't trust the voting machines, period.
Yeah, yeah,
in general.
There you go.
And I think we should all, if, you know, Bernie getting the Democratic nomination, we should all demand a paper ballot as well. As far as Sam Brownback, this whole issue, I'm hoping there'll be a real investigation and Paul Davis possibly will be put in as governor because, you know, you can say, you know, Kansas is Republican, da-da-da-da, but the one thing Kansans do not like, at least I've gotten the impression, is corruption. I don't know if you know the whole story about Vince Snowbarger.
No, I don't.
He was the representative before Dennis Moore, and he was thrown out because of corruption.
You mean you're a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, your congressman?
Yes.
Okay.
And they voted him out. So as much as, you know, some people may hold more conservative Republican values and everything, they do not. I think most of the people in this state don't like corruption, period.
Right.
It incenses them.
Yeah, I think that's probably true all over the country. So interesting. Okay, Drew, do you live in Kansas. Do you think that most Kansans are suspicious about Brownback's reelection?
I don't know. I mean, maybe in East. I think more people around here in Eastern Kansas. I think Western Kansas maybe takes it as a given because they all vote for him.
Right.
I don't know if you know that a lot of where Brownback support comes from Western Kansas because they're all religious conservatives, and they don't care about economics comparatively.
Right.
So, interesting. I mean, that's. I think if anything, more people like you said. What did you say? It was Wichita, Topeka. People, when you start to go further east in metropolitan areas, I think you have more economic type of conservatives rather than just fully religious.
Right.
And real quickly, I wanted to recommend someone to you, a scientist you might like to interview.
Okay.
His name is Gariel Wang. You were talking about gut bacteria and stuff, and I saw a whole lecture with him on this and the relevance it has to our brains.
Interesting. So, Drew, I'll have to leave that with Danielle to track down. Thank you very much for the call, and I appreciate the information. And thank you all for being with us today. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get over to pdamerica.org or democracyforamerica.com, Howard Dean's brother's site, or BernieSanders.com and sign up for the event tomorrow night. Tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.